Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is The Guardian.
Feels to me that one of the risks we run on this is that it runs as this sterile debate about the Constitution and we lose the heart out of it. Because when people come into it with the heart saying, I want to be convinced that this is going to work, then what's being put on the table is totally acceptable and totally reassures people.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Chief Political Correspondent at Guardian Australia, and today I'm with Essential Media's Executive Director, Peter Lewis. It's our fortnightly Essential Poll special on the Australian Politics podcast. Essential has made a big update on the way they're asking voters about the referendum on the Indigenous Voice, which gives us a more nuanced way to understand current public sentiment on the Voice. So let's get into the latest results. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Paul.
But first, let's start with the most important question of this political fortnight. Are the POMs whingers or are the Aussies cheats?
Well, I think virtue is clearly in the eye of the beholder. So we did test the Australian public on their views of Stumpinggate from Lords last week, Paul. 48% of Australians think that the Australians were totally justified. Another 20%, I wouldn't have done it, but the English need to get over it. 9%, same old Aussies, always cheating. 16%, what's the Ashes anyway? The only interesting thing, because I do, like everything, need to cross-tab these results. It was a huge difference in age. Like many things, our political point of cleavage is generation. So whereas older 55s, 62% totally justified, 21% wouldn't have done it, but get over it. Amongst the under 35s, it was 32-35. Between backing in the Australians totally and saying, oh, I don't feel totally right about it, but also 24% taking the un-Australian position that they don't even know what the Ashes are. So come on, younger Guardian listeners. I know the Guardian's got some great coverage of the cricket at the moment, both from the Australians over there like Jeff Lemon, who I've played many games of cricket against, and some of the British writers. So get into the Ashes. That's the big contest.
5 days is obviously too long to squeeze into the TikTok and the shorter formats that are beloved of the younger generations.
So. Yeah, they probably are better placed around baseball, and we'll talk a bit more about baseball in a moment because that is the metaphor I've tortured this week when we talk about The Voice.
Yes, you see links about how aggressive one plays and the fairness that one brings to the game between cricket and fighting a referendum campaign.
Yeah, my theory is the No campaign is running a version of political baseball where they're just flaying away, trying to keep the crowd excited and defining what virtue is. We saw over the last week, as reported in The Guardian, some really unsavoury tactics from the No campaign, including the weaponising of quite a racist newspaper ad, some push polling that doesn't pass the sniff test, and those attacks on so-called Indigenous elites, which are people that have basically managed to find a way to give something back to the communities that they come from. So I think we're in this dangerous water where one side is really trying to change the game but also own the virtue, and the other side, again, torturing my metaphor, is more about accumulating methodically the connections and the linkages we need to move the nation forward. Now, I think, as I've said previously, we are, yes, 23 campaign partners, so we're unapologetic about the position we're taking. But even stepping back from that, it seems to me there are two different games being played, and it's a really a contest of different models of politics. One, hyper-aggressive, take no prisoners and don't really care about what the implications are, and the other just trying to work through the systems of politics that we've come to not love, but the way that we build alliances and consensus across the community. And it's just interesting to see how those two cultures are clashing at the moment and creating so much noise, which is having the effect, I think, of making a lot of people that aren't totally across the detail of the debate feel really uncomfortable about the whole thing. And I'm not talking about the Ashes now, I'm talking about The Voice.
Now, let's go to The Voice results. What did you find in terms of top-line support or opposition to The Voice?
Yeah, so we have 47 support for the proposition when it's reproduced, as it will on the ballot paper, 43 opposition with 10% don't know. Listeners that have listened to this podcast previously will know that that's different from the formulation we put forward previously. We've been running one where we've been forcing a choice. We've been looking at that and we made the decision to include don't knows, a bit like we do with two party plus with our political, in that we think as the election gets closer, the undecideds become really important in this, and it's really important to see them. If people were taking that out and trying to turn that into the two-horse race, I think it's fair to say those numbers are down from where it was at 60-40 a month ago. But I also think there was something going on in the way the questions were being framed, where a lot of the don't knows on our evidence were landing in yes, but not being committed to yes. So we are pretty confident this gives a pretty good lodestar of where things are. We've got the differences still coming out in terms of age again. Amongst over 55s, it's 58-34 no. 35 to 54s, it's basically line ball, 45-43, 13% undecided. And then with younger people, it's 68-22 yes. So this is really an issue that's cleaving along generational lines, in quite a profound way. Unsurprising.
And also partisan lines as well. The coalition voters was also the lowest support. The over 55s and the coalition voters was about only one in three for yes.
Correct. Although I look at that, the coalition, given I've lost my progressive base already to the teal, so they're now sitting in the minor independent, you've got another third of your voters who are yes. And while it's also true that 26% of Labor voters say no, I think you've got to look at the way the two campaigns are being run. So my sense is that the aggressive no that is being prosecuted by the coalition has a greater propensity to be pushing back coalition voters than yes, than the more moderate sort of walk together sort of message, which Labor's running as part of that yes alliance, which while not all Labor voters agree with it, it doesn't have the same jarring effect. They're not passing judgment the same way, I don't think. Amongst Greens, it's 73 support, 18 opposed, 9 undecideds. And then you've got that mix of minor parties and independents where it's 68-25. I don't think this is terrific reading for the Yes campaign. I'll just also talk about the states. On these numbers, marginally ahead in New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, WA. We don't get enough numbers to have a real lodestar on Tassie, and Queensland behind 50-42, 8% undecided. But it's not a scoreboard. It's very clear that the undecideds, and there's still some soft yes and soft no's that are very much in play, and it's now basically going to be a battle between the media war and the ground war, where there are, you know, far more volunteers and organisations supportive of yes, but having the work to do to reach out in their communities if they want to get this over the line.
And just going back to the methodology change, what can we say about those 10% of people who are now saying that they are unsure? You've said most of them have come off the yes pile because you weren't confident that forced choice was giving an accurate reflection, but what else do we know about those people?
They're more likely to be in the middle stage of their life, marginally more likely to be Labor voters, which is interesting. gender females more likely to be undecideds, but they're quite a small sample, so it's hard to build a profile. And we've been running various focus groups as well, and there are so many people that are coming into this totally cold. You and I, because we live and breathe politics, much like I think the people listening to this podcast would be going, how can people not have a view yet? But it's really just the start of the journey for so many people. And one thing I have observed is that when people enter the conversation or the choice around the proposition of changing the constitution to recognise people through a voice with a sense of this is a good thing to do and I just want to be reassured that it is going to do what it says, that Indigenous people support it and that it will make a meaningful difference, or conversely, the status quo is not working, so let's try something different. The detail works really well. It's when people are coming with kind of an attitude of what's this, looking to poke holes in it, that the same information seems to open more and more holes. So I've been reflecting on this over the last couple of weeks. It's not, you know, often we think of polarization through the whole analogy of filter bubbles. People live in their own worlds and they're consuming different bits of information and constructing different realities. What's quite interesting about this debate is that the same bit of information is seen by people differently depending on what they're bringing to the conversation in the first place. It feels to me that one of the risks we run on this is that it runs as this sterile debate about the Constitution and we lose the heart out of it, because when people come into it with the heart saying, I want to be convinced that this is going to work, then what's being put on the table is totally acceptable and totally reassures people. The people that we're not getting are those that don't have that desire for change in their heart at the moment. So then it becomes, so what is going on with us as a nation that, you know, for many of us, and I think it bears out in the stats, that younger group who have grown up with the whole normalising of the idea of respect for First Nations cultures and commitment to reconciliation being far more on board. If your heart's there, the head will follow. But if you lead with the head, a bit like anyone that's gone through life banging the head against a brick wall, then it's pretty hard to sort of get through.
Yeah, it's quite a bind they're in, because we've spoken about this before, that you want to energise progressive voters by telling them that the voice is going to make a big practical difference to Indigenous Australians' lives. But you've also got, you know, people who are unsure about the change, or soft yes or soft no, who just want to hear that it's only one step further than symbolic recognition and it's not a radical change to the Constitution and whatnot. So they're constantly trying to get these two messages out at the same time, that it's just good manners, it's small but significant. How do you say it's going to change people's lives but it's not a big change?
And you can't have both. You can't reassure it's going to be nothing and it's going to be something. You've got to actually choose what it is that you're having the conversation about. And I think that as the proposition matures and the voter choice becomes clearer, I think that will also settle as well. One more stat that might be worth sharing, Paul, was that we were interested in sort of the profile of a yes voter versus a no voter. Another question we asked this week was around civic participation. And what we found, when people said they were actively engaged in their community, they were far more likely to vote yes. So I've volunteered in the last 12 months, 55-36 yes. I've donated to a charity in the last 12 months, 51-42 yes. I've attended a public meeting in the last 12 months, 68-27 yes. I'm part of a team or community group, which isn't so much political, just, you know, playing footy, 56-37 yes. So, and then a final one, a statement: do you agree that most people in politics are there for the right reason? Now, we didn't get an overwhelming majority of people agreeing with that, but for those who do, it's 57-36% yes. So none of this is necessarily causation, but it's definitely a correlation between people who are more civically engaged and people that are open to accept the invitation that has been put forward through the referendum process.
Mm. So if you're sitting at home watching Sky After Dark and don't talk to your neighbours or go to community meetings, you're more likely to vote no.
And if you're also listening to The Guardian podcast, you're a very strange cat.
But if you get out of your house, you attend meetings and you're civic-minded enough to think that government can be a force for good, then you vote yes.
Basically.
Interesting. Now, we asked some cost of living questions again. The last time you did this set was in April, and you found a similar proportion of people are worried about cost of living, but there are differences after a few months in terms of what people think government should be doing about it. So what did you find here?
So let's go down the list. So for each of the following indicate whether you're comfortable able to afford it, finding it a bit difficult or really struggling. Like that, the numbers struggling hasn't really gone up on household expenses, which includes mortgage and rent. It's gone up from 25 to 28, those that are really struggling, which is, you know, over a quarter of the population. On all of these, it's sort of like high 20s to 30s that people are saying they can comfortably afford. You've got about 45% in the middle finding it a bit difficult, and between 20 and 30% really struggling. Impact on cost of living, how much difference do you think the federal government could make to the cost of living? A lot, 30%, 41%, a fair amount, 17%, not that much, 5%, hardly anything. So they're not giving it a leave pass, which is interesting. Can we talk about our $100 allocation?
Before we get to that, can we look at the list of specific government interventions?
Yeah. Here we go.
Because I thought it was very interesting this week that people still think the government has a big role in fixing the cost of living. But when you asked about each of the specific measures, like price caps for electricity and gas, reduction in fuel excise, cheaper childcare, income tax cut, the support for each individual measure is down. So what do you think's behind that?
Well, let's look at these government measures. So 73% want to see a cap on price for electricity and gas. That is down from 77. And all of these were in the sort of the about 4 or 5% higher last time we asked it in April. 65% support a reduce in fuel excise, 61% all up for increasing the minimum wage, childcare cheaper, 55, that's actually down from 66. Cutting income taxes has actually dropped from 60 to 53, almost reaching that. I don't know if there needs to be a name for it, but when you get less than 50% of people wanting cuts to income tax, I think we've crossed a threshold of national fiscal rectitude. And changing industrial laws to make it easier for workers to negotiate pay rises, 49% support or saying that it will make a difference and government should do it. And again, that's down from 57. My general observation is when things get hard, people are given a list of things the government should do and they say, do it all. It's not quite there at the moment, but there is, and I think the government is quite successfully prosecuting the case that there are some things that government do that might seem like a good idea that will have perverse consequences. So I think particularly Jim Chalmers has been really good at saying that we just can't spend our way out of trouble because it does create more problems in terms of pressure on inflation. And while, you know, we are not a nation of economic graduates, I think that that piece of education is starting to cut through that. And that does bear fruit when we do look at the little exercise we gave people where we said, hey, there's a surplus of $19 billion. If that was $100, where would you allocate it? So we did an allocation exercise with a number of areas, and it is quite revealing in that the measures to sort of reduce national debt and maintain the surplus so additional spending doesn't make Australia's inflation problem worse represented 25% of the money. So they didn't put all the money into the piggy bank to stop those effects, but a quarter of it went there. The other thing that stands out here, Paul, is that the largest allocation, if the nation was allocating that $100 budget, was construction of social housing, which was $23. And I think that's interesting because that's something that is log-jammed in the Senate. I guess there's two readings of that. One, the government would say, look at all this support for social housing. Why are you holding it up, Greens? And the Greens would be saying, look at the support for housing. We've got to hold the line and keep pushing further on it. I think it's interesting in saying, of all the things, if you said to the nation, you're running the budget, you've got the money, where is it going? It's going to housing and then national debt.
I've already seen the Teal Independent, Kate Chaney, from the WA seat of Curtin, seizing on this result, saying, you know, see, we've been calling for a citizens' assembly on housing, and this shows that you know, it's a top concern of voters, and this is the sort of exercise we should be giving. You know, more ideas would be coming if we brought people to discuss it instead of in Parliament in a group of citizens. So
now, the other one here that's interesting is only $14 of the $100 would go to a one-off tax cut to ease the cost of living. So if one of the options was give me the money, people don't want much of it. In $100, they only want $14. And I'd almost put that in the fiscal constraint bucket too. So I'm going to increase that from 25% to 40% is being responsible.
I think your answer to the list of government measures and the observation here, I think the warnings about inflation are definitely reaching people, because the answers about reducing national debt and maintaining the surplus together are quite popular responses. And yeah, people haven't gone for the sugar hit of the one-off tax cut that you might expect that they would want. Yeah.
They haven't also gone for renewables and EVs, which is interesting, just $6 there. I suspect that's because people think that money's starting to flow anyway, rather than because they don't want any money in there. Because this was different. Often if you gave a list like this, people would just say, and I've got sick of running these polls, which are the important, very important, somewhat important, not very important. Everyone goes, everything's important. So if you say, here's just $100, how are you going to spend it? At least you get a sense of people's different priorities.
$9 for military support to Ukraine. It's towards the lower end of this list of measures. But when you think about the actual federal budget, I mean, that would be generous.
And one of those glorious sort of things that comes out, for some reason, if you're under 35, you're much more likely want to be spending money to the Ukraine. I don't know if that's because you're following Zelensky on TikTok or what, but that's an outlier. 14% of under 35s compared to 70% of us old farts.
Expanding Medicare to cover dental and mental health, $13 or 13%, depending which way you look at it. That's another Greens policy that they're, you know, attacking Labor on.
Yeah.
Increasing Job Seeker, 8%, also relevant this week because of the Robodebt Royal Commission recommending on Friday that instead of a compensation scheme for particular victims, there should be an overall increase in welfare to improve the dignity of people looking for work. But 8%, is that on the low side or about what you'd expect?
I don't know. You'd expect there to be an even distribution. The fact that there's not, and those are the outliers, are probably the most interesting here. I'm just looking in terms of voting as well, if anything stands up. Like, what's really interesting is construction of social housing is top of the pops for both Labor and Green voters. Liberals, it is reducing national debt. And then there's sort of, on most of the others, it's pretty much nonpartisan, like, they're all sort of between about 8 and 10%. Anyway, we'll do that again sometime. That was fun.
I think you're right about it being one of those things where it's in the eye of the beholder, where Labor and the Greens will say, see, pass the housing bill, or see, this is why we need the housing bill to be better. Yeah. Last one, we had a novelty question. This is going to help if you're pissed with your mates at the pub and you've put your sports betting app on your phone away, but you're betting each other of a different nature. What should you pick if you're playing scissors, paper, rock?
So this question might just break the game forever. 48% of people go rock first. I think it's because we're lazy, and when you're doing 1, 2, 3, you just keep your fist closed. I also feel it's a bit of a power play. It's always been my preferred. So I've always thought the alpha thing to do is just go rock and go confident. But 48% of people do it. So if you're amongst the 22% that normally start with paper, you have got a 50% chance of winning every round. And then there's 30% who are on scissors, who are like the habitual victims. So I was interested if there was any political analysis around this. Sadly, no. Liberal and Labor voters are exactly the same, as are most of the minor parties. Everyone goes for the fist. Now, I don't know what that means. I'm still not quite sure why we put it in the poll, but thanks, John Remington, for thinking about it. But, you know, 100 theories could breed off this about why rock is the anchor for most Australians.
I think it's because it's the one that you read out last. Scissors, paper, rock. It's the last one. And so if you want to test the power of the poll and the power of the podcast, come back and ask in a year and see
if everyone's,
Everyone's gone paper. Yeah. All right.
I'd love to have some greater meaning to that. And I was trying to torture the metaphors back, but I just don't think it's going to do anyone any good.
You wanted no voters to all be picking rock, didn't you?
I did do the test, I must say. We didn't put it up on voting intention on The Voice and their role of scissors, paper, rock. But, yes, there was no difference. So sometimes you learn that not all your theories are correct. Would have been a different column.
What have we got next fortnight? Star signs or, you know?
I'm actually really interested in having a look at how much the PwC and the impact of Big Four is cutting through on the Australian public. I still think it's an issue that is seen as being inside politics rather than outside politics, but I've got a suspicion that there is a bigger piece about the whole way we look at government and potentially that what's been put up as the antidote to government distrust has actually become a further source of distrust.
Very interesting. I look forward to seeing the results on that one to see how the brand damage is going for consultancies. That's all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us, Peter.
Pleasure, Paul.
This episode was produced by Mel Chun and Alison Chan. Production assistance from Karishma Luthria. Our executive producer is Miles Martignoni. Thanks for listening. We'll have another episode of Australian Politics on Saturday.
Hey, Jane Lee here. I'm one of the hosts of Full Story. And I want to tell you about a way you can catch up on some of The Guardian's award-winning journalism. It's in print and it gets delivered to your door no matter where you are in Australia. The Guardian Weekly magazine is our global news magazine, which features in-depth articles, including picks from Guardian Australia's editors. It comes out once a week and it can help you make sense of a busy news cycle. You can currently sign up and buy your first 12 issues for $12. That's just a dollar an issue. But this offer won't be around forever, so go and subscribe today at theguardian.com/weeklyaustralia.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.